One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows.
We'll just end up being a third-rate economy, you know, a banana republic.
I want an economy that works for people, not the other way around.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast that explains big economic issues in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're bringing you a conversation from our popular webinar series. The Uluru Statement from the Heart is the winner of the 2021 and 22 Sydney Peace Prize. The Australia Institute is delighted to be an impact partner for the Sydney Peace Prize this year. Today, you will hear from two architects of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the Dialogues, Pat Anderson and Professor Megan Davis. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 3rd of August, 2022, and things may have changed since recording.
So may I begin by acknowledging that Canberra, the place that I have lived and worked for the past 20 years, is Ngunnawal and Ngambri country, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm absolutely delighted to have Professor Davis and Pat Anderson join us today. And the Australia Institute is delighted to be an impact partner for this year's Sydney Peace Prize. I'm equally delighted to introduce the chair of the Sydney Peace Foundation, Archie Law, to introduce our wonderful speakers today. Thank you, Archie.
Thanks, Ebony. And good afternoon to you all from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Acknowledge the traditional custodians of these lands, elders past and present, and acknowledge all First Nations peoples attending the webinar today. On the 10th of November this year, the Sydney Peace Foundation is going to have the honour of awarding the Sydney Peace Prize to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And we're partnering with the Australia Institute to celebrate this historic event. The Sydney Peace Prize has been awarded to peacemakers around the globe for over two decades now. It's Australia's only international prize for peace, with justice and human rights at its heart. The Uluru Statement from the Heart is nothing short of a momentous and a historic peace offering to all Australians. It's a chance for all of us to take up that offer and to walk with First Nations people into Australia's future. Today, you're going to hear from two of the architects of the statement, Professor Megan Davis and Pat Anderson AO. Pat is an Aliwara woman known nationally and internationally as a powerful advocate for the health of Australia's First Peoples. She has extensive experience in Aboriginal health, including community development, policy formation, and research ethics. She has served as the co-chair of the Referendum Council, is the current chairperson of the Remote Area Health Corporation and the chairperson of the Lowitja Institute. Pat is the inaugural patron of the Women's Safety Services of Central Australia and was appointed as an officer of the Order of Australia in 2014 for her distinguished service to the Indigenous community as a social justice advocate. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Archie.
Thanks. Professor Megan Davis is a Cobble Cobble woman and Pro Vice Chancellor, Indigenous and Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales. She's Acting Commissioner of the New South Wales Land and Environment Court and was recently appointed the Belknaves Chair in Constitutional Law. She was a member of the Referendum Council and the Experts Panel on the Recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples in the Constitution. Was an expert member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues from 2011 to 2016, and is currently a member of the United Nations Human Rights Council's Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And a warm welcome to you too, Megan. We just want to invite you all to go beyond just listening today. We're urging you to play your part and take up the invitation of the Uluru Statement from the Heart of being part of an Australia that embraces peace with justice. Talk to your friends, talk to your colleagues, take action, and join us in person on the 10th of November in Sydney, when the Sydney Peace Prize is awarded in person at the Sydney Town Hall. You can get your tickets for this historic ceremony at sydneypeacefoundation.org.au. And we're urging you to be a part of this moment in history. So thank you. And back to you, Ebony.
Thank you so much, Archie. Pat Anderson, I want to begin with you today. Before we kind of get into that task ahead with the referendum, I wanted to ask you about the journey to get to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. It's a remarkable invitation, one of the most important documents in Australia's history, but I'm not sure everyone's aware of just how much work went into getting statement and all the consultation that happened. What was the process that led to the Uluru Statement from the Heart?
Before I get to this recent process, we've been doing this since before 1840. Every generation of us has had a go at getting us to be acknowledged and accepted and respected as the first peoples of this beautiful continent of ours. We've been here, the latest figure I read, over 100,000 years. It's commonly said to be 65,000, but of course that's what the scientists say. But for us, we believe we have always been here. We didn't come from anywhere else. This is definitely, absolutely our place over millennia. This current process, though, began with Julia Gillard about, I don't know, 12 years ago. We've had, Megan will be able to correct me, I think we had like eight committees over this period, and the final process, well, the process that we have on the table now, the Uluru Statement from the Heart, came from the Referendum Council, and which Megan was a part of, as was Noel, and I co-chaired with Mark Liebler. We went out and asked First Nations people how they wanted to be recognised and what do they need now at this time. And through a whole process of 13, which we call regional dialogues all over the country, we had a deliberative process designed and led by, was designed by Megan and led by all of us. There was no public servants. It was just us, plus the people that were invited. Now, the Referendum Council didn't invite anybody to those forums. We selected a host organisation. We gave them the formula for who should come. Don't forget we needed to have women as well as men and young people, and that we wanted 60% to come from the traditional custodians and landowners, 20% from organisations and also stolen generations, people that perhaps didn't fit into the categories, and also 20% of people who are important to the region and influential. So every meeting had that same structure, if you like. It was 2.5, nearly 3 days, and we had them in 13 locations. Each of those meetings, the host organisation was to also invite people from the region. So it was an education process as well, over 3 days. It was a deliberative process and required everyone a lot of work, and people worked really hard, sometimes on abstract concepts. Each meeting was recorded, and then from we selected all those notes and remarks and everything that people said and the conclusions that they came to after a three-day process. And the team then, Megan and her team, did an analysis of everything that was said. We presented that document at the convention, or each meeting was asked, their last duty was to select 6-7 people from that meeting to go and be their delegate at the convention. So the Referendum Council didn't elect anyone except choose a host organisation. So the delegates that came to Uluru were sent by all of those meetings to be their delegate and to speak on their behalf at the convention. From the convention and that whole process came the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And this was decided by that meeting to give this as a gift of hope, peace, even love to the Australian people, because people told us in the dialogues that we asked the population, the Australians, in 1967 to help us. And we're going to ask them again and they'll help us, because there was a widely held belief that Australians were basically decent people. So that's why it was very much on purpose, because it's you, everyone out there and everyone else who isn't here, it's you who can change the nature of the country, can change the narrative. You have the power not the the politicians have to set the machinery up. And there's been a huge ingredient that's been added to this whole process, this latest one of 12, 14 years, by the courageousness, the courage rather, of the Prime Minister, who's the first thing he said as the Prime Minister, that he would take, meaning that he would take the country to a referendum. And at Gama, which was just an amazing gathering of all kinds of people, he made the announcement of a draft set of questions. So, and the only thing he's got to do, well, he's got to do lots of things. We all have lots of things to do. But nevertheless, we are definitely, as all Australians, we're going to a referendum and we're going to be asked to vote yes or no. Very simple question. If you've read the questions, the drafts, have a look at it. There's only two possible answers, yes or no. That's it. So that's where we're at now after this very, very long process. But everybody over 18 in Australia today has the opportunity to, this is part of nation building. It will change the narrative for the country and hopefully it will change the way that you all relate to us and we will have some power to make decisions about all the things that affect us and try to fix this torment of our powerlessness. That's where we're at now.
Thank you, Pat. Megan Davis, coming to you next, and congratulations to you both on getting it just to this point where we are on the cusp of having a referendum with this this question to be put to the Australian people. But the statement calls for voice, treaty and truth. There are those two other elements. Megan, how important is the sequence of those elements? How important is it that voice comes first?
Yeah, so the Uluru Statement does refer to the constitutional element of a voice to parliament and then a Makarrata Commission to supervise agreement making and truth telling. So the sequence, you know, is important in a number of senses. The first being that, you know, the past 12 years, I mean, it really depends on what where your starting point for the recognition process is. Some take it as the preamble in the Republic referendum, so 1999, and really the multi-party support for a referendum on recognition started then. Some take it as John Howard, who committed to a constitutional referendum on recognition in 2007, about 4 days before the federal election in 2007. But most, I think, take it from the point in which Julia Gillard was able to negotiate power in the lower house through the two independents, Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott, and the Greens, Adam Band. In their letter of agreement with Gillard, they said that she needed to move on this multi-party support for constitutional recognition and get the nation to a referendum was in the terms of reference. So that kind of that started in 2011, and so we're in our kind of second decade of recognition in Australia. A lot of work has gone on, 7 processes, 10 reports. There's a lot of material there for that decade. But the opportunity on the table, Ebony, is for constitutional recognition. So treaty and truth aren't things that are done at that constitutional level. Although we took treaty out to the process, the deliberative dialogues, you know, the movement has always anticipated that there would be some kind of mechanism at a Commonwealth level for agreement making. But in this instance, the opportunity on the table was bipartisan, multi-partisan support for constitutional recognition. And so through that deliberative dialogue process, the form of constitutional recognition that came to the fore as the most prominent was a constitutionally enshrined voice to parliament. So that is first, because that is the opportunity on the table. And that is, in terms of political imperative, that kind of multi-party support, keeping in mind the complexities of the current situation as we are getting to closer to a referendum, that is what is on the table. In terms of agreement making and truth telling, it was always envisaged that that would be done through some sort of mechanism that enables those two things to come together. And so the Makarrata Commission will be set up. I'm just not sure at what point. I think Linda Burney has discussed setting it up now, setting it up after a referendum. I mean, those decisions are made by by the government of the day in terms of resources. But the sequence is really important. And I just want to make one point about truth telling. You know, there is no significant, there's no treaty in the world that needed a truth process first. Yeah. So truth telling is something that has been really prominent post kind of the 1990s, when we had this emergence of a transitional justice framework in the international community to try and grapple with the way in which you have regimes move from kind of dictatorship to democracy. And how do you deal with all of those issues so that people can live, you know, who were once, you know, victim and perpetrator can move to the new democratic society, and those issues that occurred in the previous regime would be dealt with. I think the very strong sentiment in all the dialogues is we've done a lot of truth-telling in Australia. In fact, it's been used on multiple occasions by the state to avoid substantive recognition of rights. And I take, for example, Bob Hawke not being able to deliver on national land rights or on a treaty that he promised, but rather because he couldn't deliver on substantive rights, he kicked the nation down into a decade-long period of truth-telling. And we emerged out of that decade long with a Conservative government who rejected it all. So truth telling is important, but the dialogues didn't really use that language of truth. They talked about Australian history. They talked about their place in Australian history and what can be done in terms of education in primary schools and high schools to educate Australians better on the place of First Nations people in Australian history. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that this isn't a transitional justice truth-telling process. This is about the original grievance, something that occurred in 1788 and that hasn't been dealt with. And it's really important not to impose really modern-day things like that across that original kind of grievance that we're trying to resolve with this first step through the Uluru Statement. So the sequence is really important. And certainly from our discussions with our brothers and sisters in Canada, they've had four truth-telling processes and are saying it has elicited no substantive change in community attitudes towards First Nations peoples and race. And as someone who's worked with the United Nations for 20 years, I think we do need to scrutinise this idea that education is the sole, public education is the sole way to get Australians to a place where they might vote yes for a treaty, or they might vote yes for something else. I mean, I think we need to problematize the idea that you need a truth-telling process before this, because we've got plenty of evidence of the truth in this country. Truth is not what we're short of.
Megan, I just wanted to stay with you. Thanks for that explanation. I think that was really clear. We do have now some potential draft wording from the Prime Minister that he announced at the Gama Festival. I just wondered if you could talk to us a little bit more about the importance of this being enshrined in the Constitution, and also how important is it that this question is simple and straightforward, that the proposition that people are voting on is a straightforward one?
So, you know, it's as I said, you know, in the kind of clamouring for detail, which, you know, I think within 8 weeks of taking office, they've done a pretty good job of bringing together some initial detail to, I think, meet the curiosity. Look, the voice to Parliament, let's just start with the notion of recognition. So this is a recognition project that's been in play for 12 years, yeah? So in the initial process set up by Gillard, the expert panel on the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the Constitution, both major parties pushed back on a non-discrimination clause, yeah? They said that no one's going to vote yes for that at a referendum. So a lot of that work between the expert panel and the referendum council was about, well, what does recognition actually look like then if we're looking for something that, you know, might get support, political support to get it across the line, in addition to support from our own people, because there is, of course, a lot of complexity around what a non-discrimination clause may or may not do, including the fact that a non-discrimination clause couldn't, you know, absolutely foolproof the future from having a parliament that might pass discriminatory laws, that's still permitted under a non-discrimination clause, which kind of turned away a lot of our people from that as a solution or as something that they see as constitutional recognition. So then we moved to this referendum process where we needed to actually retrofit a process where we went out to communities to talk about what does recognition look like in your community. So the way in which it was set up, it was only a sample of MOP, but a robust sample of MOP. And it was, as Pat said, we auspiced the IATSIS, the Institute, to engage local communities or land councils and local communities to fill an invitation list of about 100, with 60% of those participants being traditional owners, elders, and our cultural authority. And in the course of that deliberative process, all of them ranked an enshrined voice as number one. Now, your question is, why is an enshrined voice so important? So there's a number of answers to that. One of the first things that we noted in every single dialogue around the country was the destruction that was wrought in communities when ATSIC was abolished, because it was literally abolished overnight without any consultation or discussion with any First Nations people. And although the nation kind of labours under this, or some in the nation labour under this idea that ATSIC was ineffective, that is certainly not what First Nations peoples think as a kind of universal view. There was a lot of complexity around the positives and negatives of ATSIC. The ATSIC review had a lot of really important ideas about devolving power to the regions and abolishing that national board. But of course, the whole thing was abolished instead. And it's very difficult. So there's a lot of people that are clamoring for legislation so they can see what the model looks like. But there's not that many people in Australia who would be able to assess such a model, right? Assess the complexities of a full-blown piece of legislation, because the bulk of people don't work in that sector. And the people with the experience and the knowledge of the Aboriginal sector and what a model will look like are those people that live in communities. And what they said in dialogues and what they said before that, and this is all recorded, is that they are voiceless and powerless in their own country. They don't think that their organisations represent them properly. They don't think, you know, the national peaks speak for them. They don't think anyone speaks for them. They feel like nobody represents their voice. And so the dialogues were designed in a way that we did exclude from participation people who have, you know, those parliamentary passes where you're a professional lobbyist, or you have a big highfalutin CEO job with a huge pay running a kind of Aboriginal organisation, or politicians. We kept the politicians out. We kept lawyers out. We kept out the people who have a voice, yeah? Anyone who has a voice, that's not who the dialogues were for. We wanted to hear from people about what they thought was needed in their region, and that's why the voice to parliament was prominent. People didn't want to sit in the parliament, so there is a kind of, yes, we've got a huge number of Aboriginal politicians now, but not everybody wants to be a politician. Not all Australians aspire to that. They don't want to join professional political parties. They don't want to represent an electorate. You know, they don't want to represent political kind of party platforms. So that's why designated seats and reserved seats weren't regarded highly either. That is not what people want. They want to live in their own communities. That's what they do. They're community people who live among their people and work for their people and help their people. They don't want to be politicians. But what they do want is their view represented to the people who are making laws and policies about their lives. So the voice to parliament is a very common kind of mechanism used by a lot of Western liberal democracies to improve the input and the participation of Indigenous peoples in the democratic life of the state. It's very, very common. And part of the problem is that Western liberal democratic governance is predicated on, and all of the human rights jurisprudence around democratic governance and the right to vote is all predicated on a ballot box alone, right? So if you have a ballot box election, that's democracy. But what most countries in the world have found, that that's not democracy, because what it does is it means that both parties only speak to the mean, to the kind of majoritarian view of Australians. And if you're a vulnerable group who fall outside of the majority, then often your views aren't taken into account properly, or they're traded, they're horse traded for other issues. So Bob Hawke said yes to a treaty and then said no to a treaty because he needed to win the West Australian election to retain government. So I think Pat Anderson says it best when she says, the voice is all about removing us as a political football. It's about taking us out of the realm of political ideology and placing us in another spot where we don't have to worry about going cap in hand to Canberra every 3 years and begging. It is about removing us from that politics so we can have a more durable and sustainable and long-term view in our communities of what we need to do and what we need to get done. So the voice to Parliament is an enabling provision that sets up into the Constitution the power for the Commonwealth to pass a law that creates a First Nations voice. And that will be done after the referendum and after a comprehensive process of consultation has occurred, or I would prefer deliberative dialogues have occurred, so that the mob can design the voice themselves. So that's the question will be simple. The amendment is often not debated. It doesn't normally dominate the debate, but what needs to dominate the debate is that in a recognition exercise, there's the to be recognised, which are the First Nations, and there's the recognise all, which is the Australian people, right? Not the politicians, the Australian people. The politicians are there because Australians have put them there. So that's the exercise. And the to be recognised have to agree to that form of recognition. We rejected symbolism and we said that, or the dialogue participants said, and Uluru said, the people gathered at that rock, that a constitutionally enshrined voice to Parliament is what we consider recognition.
Pat, I want to come back to you now, as Megan has so clearly explained why the constitutional recognition is important. But after so long now, we have a real commitment from the Labor government to take the voice question to a referendum. We've got some draft words. There's still some work to be done. But what do you think this next period looks like? And how can we all get behind a yes vote for this referendum question?
I think Megan has just very eloquently answered part of that question. And I'll just sort of stick with the mechanics of it. What has to happen now, and it will happen, this is going to be really difficult. This is going to be a difficult conversation, but we're all duty bound morally to do it, to have it once and for all. We will continue doing the education that we've done over all the year, over the last 5 years. But now we have something on the table, and that's clearly the referendum. So we will continue with our education campaign going around the country as we have been for the last 5 years, and kept the whole question alive, quite frankly. So now we'll be able to go around and talk a little bit more concretely, if you like, about all of the stuff that Megan has just said, so people properly understand what it is that we're doing here. So we'll have time now to do that. So we will continue to do all of that and address the issues that arise, and hopefully give a sort of general overview to the general public of how what it is that we're asking for and why, and how some idea of how it will work between now and when the referendum is called. There will be quite a lot of information that will come out. But, you know, there's a responsibility, I think, on all the voters to inform themselves as well. And I would refer you all to our website, uluru-statement.org. On there, for instance, there's a whole lot of information which will answer some of the questions that might be coming up now. The answers are already on our site. There's a whole lot of information there, a whole lot of resources. But more importantly, for the listeners out there, one of the things that we have done, we have the Uluru Statement from the Heart translated into 61 languages as well as English, including about 21 First Nations languages. So you can read the Uluru Statement in your own language. It's my job to add more First Nations languages there, and I'm currently working on that, but there's not one place that I have to find the language nest, what have you. But there's plenty of information there for people to inform themselves, to read a bit about it, understand, have discussions about it. It's really important. So try to actively engage, you know, mind and heart in this process, because as I said earlier, it is nation building, and it will make a huge influence on the outcomes for our families and our communities across Australia. And that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to see if I can share with you polling that the Australia Institute has done over the last couple of months, asking people would they vote yes to an amendment enshrining voice in the Constitution. And between June and July, support for the voice has increased, which is really exciting. But Pat, is your sense, do you have a sense of optimism? Do you think people are receptive to this at this point? Certainly that polling shows that as people learn more about it, there's definitely some majority support there for that idea.
Yes, we've done some polling ourselves as well, and so figure there that you had of undecided. It's turned out from the polling that we've done, once they have been spoken to or read something, or they're easily convinced, and that undecided vote turns into a yes vote. So there's quite a lot of polling that we've done as well over the years. But, you know, I don't want to be Pollyanna here, but I think there is a shift. There is people are much more optimistic. I think that at the last election, I think people voted for hope and for change. The electorate voted for hope and change. It was a nerve-wracking election. It was very exciting. But, you know, we have a parliament now that we've never had before. You know, and we've got social media, which we didn't have in 67. So I think the parliament that we have now, I think it's broken or begun to break the stranglehold of the two-party system. So it's a completely different parliament, which is also very exciting. We have a prime minister who is courageous and, in fact, also has a heart. So, and it's increasing support as people understand more and more about it. I think this is the best chance that we've had for a long time. And I'll stand corrected, but I don't think we've ever had a prime minister that's come out so courageously as our current prime minister has on any issue to do with blackfellas. So there's a lot of things in our court. But as I say, it's the people of Australia who will decide. But I think this is the best chance we've had for decades. So I think we've got a chance here, I believe.
Excellent. Before we go to questions from the audience, Megan, I wondered if I could ask you about some of the arguments coming out from that No campaign that we've had so far, and how much traction do you think those types of arguments will get, whether or not it's the idea from Tony Abbott that this is kind of setting apart a particular racial group. I know I've heard some people comment that, you know, it's nothing to do with that. It's the First Nations voice. It's the original inhabitants who've been here for many years. How concerned are you about some of those no campaign arguments coming out? And do you have anything that you kind of would like to share with the audience to, I guess, illuminate some of those issues?
Oh, look, I mean, it's like 8 weeks, right, into a new government. The people you expect to be anti-Indigenous voice, anti-referendum, are the people talking up, yeah? They were writing in the first couple of weeks of government before we even had detail. And it doesn't matter how much detail you give and how little detail you give, they're still going to be seen from the same hymn book, right? Because it's a business model. You know, it's really important as people who support the voice to understand that most Australians aren't paying attention right now. And those Australians who are need to be informed of what the Uluru Statement from the Heart is and what this recognition process was, right? It's not trickery. It's not something that's just been made up. It's been 11 years and every single thing has been done transparently. It's been published by the Parliament, you know, their prime ministerial bodies that have led this work. It's all been done in plain sight. It's just, you know, the mainstream media haven't paid attention. And that's not dissimilar to the last federal election, right? If you read The Australian, Fairfax, and many of the mainstream media outlets leading up to the election, you would never have known that the election results were what they were, yeah? So with the big Green vote, the big independent vote, the low primary votes of both major parties, that is the Australian people saying, we have had enough of this adversarial, acrimonious stuff, and we want solutions. We want better policy. We want you to talk about climate change in a kind of non-childish way, but in a serious way, because all of us Australians can feel it and see it. The same with the Integrity Commission, and Australians like just had it up to the roof with corruption, and the same with the Uluru Statement from the Heart. That's a really important thing to keep in mind when we watch the ways in which this debate is being driven and manufactured by mainstream media right now. And so we expect those kinds of arguments to come out. We expect there to be pushback. But I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that this is not the Republic referendum. there's a lot of people just, you know, you use the language of no campaign, there might not be a no campaign, right? I know you're using it in a metaphorical sense, but this doesn't have to be adversarial. It doesn't have to be racist. It doesn't have to be acrimonious. It can just be a decent, respectful conversation with Australians about why we seek constitutional recognition. And that's what the Uluru Statement from the Heart is. It is a letter. It is an invitation to the Australian people. We lay out the logic of the Uluru Statement and then we ask them to come meet us at the Rock and walk on this journey of the Australian people for a better future. And that's not Pollyanna, right? This is decades and decades of our people having to cop really crappy policy and really crappy laws and have no import. And most Australians can look at the Closing the Gap failures and say, look, we put all of this money at this framework and it's not working. And why isn't it working? Because we're never at the table when they make decisions about us. So, you know, right now I'm not so worried about the political pundits and the political elites who spend more time in kind of jets and hanging out with politicians than they do on the ground with ordinary Aussies. And that's where we need to be. So there's many, many kind of, you know, answers to things like race, culture, formal equality, substantive equality, that you know, we'll, you know, prosecute over the course of the journey to the referendum. I would, in terms of answering some of those things, like Tony Abbott, who, I mean, I'm not even sure, you know, I think I need to separate disingenuous, you know, op-eds from the ones that are actually genuinely asking, you know, Australians need to vote as an informed group. It needs to be an informed vote, and that is what we want to get them to. So on the UluruStatement.org website, there's a lot of resources around this. In addition, there's a link to an Indigenous constitutional law blog where a lot of these questions are talked about and answered. It's called the IndigCon Law Blog, really original, I know. But really, I think the most important thing to start with before we get to those important questions of alignment with Australian democratic culture is for Australians to understand what the recognition process is. Where does it come from and why are people wanting to seek recognition of our voice? So the Uluru Statement from the Heart, you know, you can go to the UluruStatement.org website and it's actually like 18 pages, the Uluru Statement. People only read the first. But after the first page is about four pages that explain why voice was chosen and not a non-discrimination clause. So I saw one question in the chat by someone saying, you know, the NT preferred a non-discrimination clause, but the initial Northern Territory response was done under the plenary powers. So the biggest problem for the territories is their plenary power. They're not a state. No section 116A is going to fix that for you. So this document takes people through the reasoning, the legal reasoning that Mob went through to get to the voice to parliament. Why was a non-discrimination clause put to one side for a voice to parliament? And partly it was so that we would have upfront political empowerment as opposed to just a right that sits in the constitution that you take to the High Court, maybe, if the federal parliament does something. But this document's amazing, the Uluru Statement. It's the first document, the Uluru Statement. Then you've got the legals, and then the end part is what we call our story. So it's actually the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander story of Australia. It's beautiful. And I think when you read that story, it gives me goosebumps to read it, you'll understand what it was that these incredible 13 dialogues did and what's the impetus, what's the motivation behind the Uluru Statement and Voice Treaty Truth. And then from that, from an informed basis about recognition, you know, we can have those discussions about whether or not, you know, a voice to parliament is embedding culture in the, I think Tony Abbott says race in the constitution. He mustn't realise that section 5126 exists. Race already exists in the constitution, yeah? So, you know, I'm not so concerned about his because he was never going to support, but I think it's important to have the recognition discussion. What is that about? Because that's an important question. And then the second being like, let's have a conversation about why this is in alignment with Australian political and legal culture. And at the end of the day, it's the Australian people standing alongside Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that changed the constitution. And so I think it's really important that when this does get up, that we see it as a reflection of the fact that, yeah, it does align. Most Australians think it's fair that when you pass laws and policies that are about our communities, we're at the table. And as the most magnificent Florence Onus has put in the chat, you know, we don't seek a green voice. We don't seek a red voice. We don't seek a blue voice. We seek a black voice. And that's a really important, I think, that's a really important motto to keep in mind.
I've got a question here from Natalie Bryant. Natalie, I'm not sure if you're the Nat that I went to Nets with and Pomo High, but Natalie asks, there's been a lot of discussions around the need to talk to mob in regional and remote Australia. As an urban Indigenous person with no significant links to an LALC or Indigenous organisation, how will I be engaged going forward? Pat, would you like to take that one first?
We'll be talking to you as well as we get around. It's not, well, we picked that specifically because that's what everybody, you know, seems to complain about. We've done quite a lot of work. Lots of the remote communities were, in fact, at the convention and during the course of the regional dialogues, as we did in the cities and the urban areas, as rural areas as well. So this time round, we'll have a few more resources and we will know where we're going. So yes, we'll speak to as many people as we possibly can, but we need for you to not to be passive. If it's not happening, you get onto our webpage, send us an email, ring us up or whatever. We'll do whatever we need to do to get this over the line. And Megan's explained it all so eloquently and beautifully. How can you not take regard and inform yourselves about what's actually happening here? Please read the documents that Megan have spoken about. They're on our website. They're very touching, very moving, but also good explanations.
I've got another question here from Kirsten Anker and quite a few questions that are interested in the process, I guess. And Kirsten asked, can you please speak a little bit more about the role of women in this process and how that works?
Women are leading this process. There's no doubt about that. It's like it was in 67, it's women. It's Aboriginal women and Torres Strait Islander women who are leading this campaign, that, and we have done from day one. That's another reason why we suggested to the organisers of the regional dialogues that they have an equal number of women, men, young people as well. So, and there was that mix at all of those meetings. So I can honestly say this is absolutely, this campaign, for any criticism I might get, it is definitely led by women from in all of the jurisdictions. It's the women who are the main spokespersons. We do have lots of supporting men, of course, but the majority of the leadership is all women, but aided by some very generous, loving men.
Anything you want to add to that, Megan?
No, it's just been a pleasure to have hooked up with Aunty Pat in 2015 when she became the co-chair, and I've learned a lot under her leadership. And, you know, it is a very large cohort of women that, you know, got together every Friday night for a Zoom for 5 years. And getting this across the line, and then our Uluru Youth are led by women as well. And yeah, it is very much, it's a pretty incredible process, I think.
The next question I've got is Lisa Kane. She asks, what do you think is the most important step people can take to support the referendum at this point in time?
So, I mean, I think Pat, so of course we appreciate we're well down the road in terms of knowledge and understanding of Uluru, and that a lot of people are just coming into the space. So I think Pat's made, I think visiting the Uluru Statement website, I think taking a bit of a look around the Referendum Council report, if people are that way inclined, they might not want to. There's a lot of resources available, but especially I think our story is a good start, because the way in which each of the dialogues started was we had to build in the kind of early part of the dialogue, add on an extra day to deal with mob wanting to talk about Australian history and expressing a very earnest lament. Don't they want to know who we are? Why don't they want to know our experience in our own country? And that drove us to then later go back through all of the records and meetings, because every single dialogue was, as Aunty Pat said, it was recorded, and every single dialogue had a record of meeting at the end that every single participant signed off on. And we did not leave that room unless they'd signed off on it. And that's really key, because as you know, I'm on the key United Nations body that implements the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it was really important for me as a UN Indigenous human rights lawyer that free prior and informed consent underpinned the work that we did in the dialogues. So that record of meeting, when you went through it, there was this rich story of Australia in every dialogue region about stories Australians don't know of what have happened to our people. And so reading our story, I think, is a really important way of getting into the space, and then reading the Uluru Statement from the heart, and then taking a look at those three pages. I think they're really useful to see, why didn't we suggest amending the racist power? Why didn't we choose a non-discrimination clause? Why did every dialogue reject symbolism? And it's very simply written. It's not deep legal text. And I think that's a good way to get into this. And then so from there, the number one thing I think Pat and I always say, go and talk to five people that you know. Some might know about Uluru and some might not. And you can start that conversation by saying, Albanese in his victory speech, you know, and a week ago he decided X, Y, and Z. And start having those conversations and yarns with just people, your family, you know, your friends. And that's how this is going to happen, is through word of mouth. Because Pat and I are going to try and get around, someone's asked about urban communities, we're going to try and get around to as many places as possible, face-to-face to yarn, with masks on, but just to have a cup of teas with people and have those yarns. As Pat said, come to our website. We've got an email address where we are running a couple of Zooms where Pat and I will host just Zooms with cup of teas where we yarn. And that's how it was done in 67, and that's how it can be done now. You know, we don't want this to be highfalutin kind of elitist campaigning, but it's actually on the ground in communities with people we know, with people they know. We've teamed up with FECA and all the multicultural ethnic organisations of Australia who want to yarn about this, want to vote yes. And we hope to partner really closely with our multicultural brothers and sisters, because, you know, together we're the, you know, as the census stats say, we're the future of Australia. Australia is a new country in 10 years. It's not what it was, you know, during the Howard era. And I think that the last election speaks to that. The nation is changing. So that's yarning, you know, if you support it, that's what we think. And if you've got big questions that you're really worried about, that you really would like some help to answer, you can email the ILC, you know, the Indigenous Law Centre at unsw.edu.au, and we try to help and answer as many community questions that come in. So that's just us. We're just like, this is not our day job. We've got jobs. This is just two women, you know, helping to lead the people that were involved in Uluru and people we want to support recognition on the smell of an oily rag. We're not like a big, you know, Albanese only just announced it. I don't know what campaigns will look like. We're just doing our little bit and our footprint to get this across the line. And so feel free to reach out, and we will endeavour to do what we can to help Australians be informed to make this vote.
Pat Anderson, this next question I think I want to put to you, and it's about winning the Sydney Peace Prize. How did you feel when you heard that news, and how important has that been for amplifying the voice of the Uluru Statement from the heart? I know we're in quite a different political situation now than prior to the election, but what was that like, hearing that the Peace Prize had been awarded to the Uluru Statement from the heart that you've worked so hard on?
It was really, really amazing. We had a whole host of different emotions racing through all of us at that very announcement. But once we recovered from that, we couldn't believe it, of course. But once we recovered from that, we realised that this was really, really important to the campaign and the work of the Uluru Statement and the work that the nation now has to do, now that we have the Uluru Statement from the heart on the table. So it's a huge boost for the whole thing. So it came very timely. I know COVID sort of put everything back a bit, but it was perfect timely, and it was a great honour. But also too, it was a tribute to all of those voiceless people who are not elites, as they've been called yesterday. They're just people out there doing what they do, and they're not the sort of people that are going to go on the drum or go on Q&A. They're just doing about their business. So the Sydney Peace Prize, in my view, was a tribute to all of those people that turned out for 3 days to wrestle with the complexities of this whole question, and they did. And now we have the Prime Minister supporting it, and we will now take the country to a referendum on that issue. So the Sydney Peace Prize was hugely significant and important, but a tribute to all of those voices people out there who attended.
And Megan, did you want to add anything to that?
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to add, apart from what I've already said, we do have a right to your MP thing on our website. And I think it's important to, you know, really keep the pressure on. And even though there's been the announcement, I think it's really important for Labor to see that and be encouraged. But also if you're in a LNP seat or any other seat, writing to your local MP is really important because that's what's kept us alive since Turnbull said no. And the last thing I just want to say, you know, Uluru was all about imagining that the world could be a better place. When we went into those dialogues, people were in really difficult situations. They were grappling with the Tony Abbott Indigenous Advancement Strategy. People were really, as Aunty Pat used to say, on their knees, struggling and felt really voiceless and powerless. And I think we used to go and say, we're sorry to come and talk about the Constitution for 3 days, but, you know, you need to suspend your disbelief that the nation can't change. You need to suspend your disbelief that Australians won't understand what you're trying to say. And we need you to imagine that the world can be a better place. And they did get angry on the first day, but on the second day they rocked up, Aunty Pate, to the morning, sleeves rolled up, and they were incredible. And they came up with a solution that no other constitutional lawyer had come up with prior to this process. And I think it's an important challenge to Australians too. They've got to imagine a better future and what that this means for our nation and what an opportunity that it presents for us to realise this now in our lifetime in a way that may never, ever come again. You know, the stars are in alignment. We have a leader that is supportive. That is the most important thing for a constitutional moment. So like we did in the election, you know, we said, you know what, we want Australia to be a better place. And that was that result. And that's what we need to do in this referendum. And that will honour all of our old people, Aunty Pat, who fought for the past 80 years have sacrificed so much. Our old people, our elders. This will be honouring their work if we can get this across the line.
Yeah. Well, we might have to wrap it up there. Thank you to our guests, Pat Anderson and Professor Megan Davis, as well as Archie Law. Congratulations on the Sydney Peace Prize and on all your hard work to get things to this point. It's an amazing achievement. Thanks also to the Sydney Peace Foundation. Don't forget to check out their website to get your tickets to all those Peace Week events and to head on over to Uluru Statement, was it .org? UluruStatement.org?
Yeah, UluruStatement.org.
Excellent. Thank you all for tuning in. Stay safe out there. Vote yes at the referendum and we'll see you next time. We've had such an overwhelming response to the webinar today. I'm sure we'll do more of these and continue to keep you updated on the campaign as it progresses. And if I can manage to make this work, we're going to go out with audio of Megan herself reading the Uluru Statement from the Heart.
Uluru Statement from the Heart. We, gathered here at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion. The ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom remain attached thereto and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise, that peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionally, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alien from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement making between governments and First Nations and truth telling about our history.
In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard.
We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. And we invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Our podcast producer is at Jennifer Macy, and this podcast was edited by Lizzie Jack. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening.